Radnorshire itself probably never really been able to would have been able to support the recruitment of its own regiment. There have been militias in Radnorshire in the past, and indeed those of you that go and see Thomas Jones, that statue of the guy outside the bandstand there, go and see his grave in Kaibar Chapel. His inscription on his tablet does detail the association of his family with the Radnorshire militia. Now, the yeomanry regiments were largely there as a sort of emergency militia, and a lot of the time they were used to quell problems with the civilian population, for example in the Chartist riots in the 19th century. They were not professional military. It was some guy that was a yeoman farmer or something one day, then he was called out, he got on his horse, he had a cutlass and he could go around chopping people's heads off, as indeed they did at Peterlee in Manchester when these things got out of hand there. There had been a tradition in Radnorshire and in the south of Powys, really, of going into the South Wales Borders. That's more in Brecknock. There was a tradition of going in Radnorshire into the 1st Battalion of the Herefordshire Regiment as well. And in fact, the 1st Battalion of the Herefords was called something like the Radnor and Hereford Regiment or something like that. Therefore, really, this explains the reason why we're in the Montgomery Yeomanry here and not the Radnor Yeomanry. This regiment had served in the Boer War and throughout the 19th century, its various incarnations. Now, when the British Army went off to the Boer War, everybody expected they would do very well because, of course, they were British soldiers. The upshot of this was that they actually had a complete and total kicking. Boer commanders absolutely slaughtered them. Standards of soldiering were very, very, very poor. Standards of musketry were absolutely appalling. Now, the upshot of this was really two or three things. One, when they came back, Lord Roberts founded the National Rifle Association, which popularised small bore shooting in this country, so that civilians could actually join shooting clubs and actually practice their targetry, so they could then actually then join the army in time for war. That is why round the country we've got hundreds of little small bore rifle clubs. For example, in the bottom of the Houses of Parliament, there's a rifle range. You know, various railway clubs used to have rifle ranges, particularly around Landrinth as well. There's several rifle ranges, small bore and full bore. 1908, a guy called Lord Haldane reforms the yeomanry. Forms what's known as the Territorial Force, now known as the Territorial Army. In fact, the TA had its 100th anniversary last year. These guys would have met at the drill hall in Andrinded, which is now underneath where Tesco's is. In fact, the drill hall was there until about 6 months ago. Part of the deal for Tesco's was they built a new one. But that drill hall had been there since around 1909. The Montgomerys were not the only people that met there. The Herefords had a detachment there, and the King's Shropshire Light Infantry met there as well. Start of the war, the Montgomery Yeomanry consists of four squadrons. A squadron, which is up at Llanfyllin. B squadron is down at Welshpool. That is also the headquarters squadron. C squadron up at Newtown. And D squadron down at Landrinded. Now, the late Victorians, Edwardians, early Georgians were very clubbable sort of people because there was no telly. They went out and they did stuff. So they went out and they went to poetry evenings and Landrinded. The lads would do things like join the Territorial Army because, of course, you've got a nice posh uniform, and indeed the dress uniform of the yeomanry was actually quite smart. It looked, if those of you see the Trooping of the Colour, had actually seen the Horse Guards, they actually looked a little bit like this with these big hats and these big plumes off the top. You also got, when you went on the annual summer camp, 3 weeks under canvas. And that really, for some people, was about as close as they were going to get to a summer holiday. So it was quite, and of course you got your annual bounty as well. So it was good reasons to join. And the comradeship, and most CA formations have a cheap subsidised bar. So there was a bit of that, probably a bit of that going on as well. Outbreak of war, that is D Squadron, Montgomeryshire Yeomanry. That is Landrinder's cavalry. That picture is taken as they are formed up on the muster for the start of the First World War. Okay? Well, I can see some frantic pointing going on in the audience. because there are two highways somewhere in that picture. One of them's over here. Yep. And the other one is somewhere there. Those of you that are local may know Jeff Micah, that's his uncle. This chap at the back here has obviously just joined, hasn't got a uniform, so they've stuck him right at the back. Because he's not smart enough. They are actually, considering they're a territorial force, spectacularly well-dressed, because they're all wearing more or less the same thing. And it's a standing joke for the rest of us in the other services. The army, they don't, you know, they wear what they like. The number of uniforms and possible combinations you have are huge. They are standing on what is now Tesco's car park, which at the time was the Lanark Common. There's the railway station, there's the police station, down here's the Lanark. Now, as Territorial Force soldiers, they were, indeed the Territorial Force was designed for home defence, so these guys actually had no obligation to go off and fight the Hun overseas at all. They could have quite nicely sat out the war doing garrison duty somewhere. But when asked, okay lads, who wants to come and have a crack at the Hun? They volunteered to a man, which really is not surprising, because of course, you know, if you're going to stand in the Lanark having a pipe with two mates and they've both volunteered, the peer pressure to do so must have been immense. You know, people in non-uniform wandering the streets used to get white feathered. So this is the start of the war, and there's quite a bit of hurrahing and patriotism, and they volunteer to a man. Now, bearing in mind that these are in fact a cavalry regiment, you will notice in this picture a certain absence of one commodity. Horses. And in fact, I do think it does say on the... yes. Something about, you know, yeah, you don't need to own a horse or something.
Being able to ride preferred.
Yeah, there we are. But not experience not required. Yeah, not necessary. Now, start of the war, the government horse traders went out and started buying just about every nag that had a leg on each corner. And many a poor young girl, you know, woke up one morning and found out that Dobbin had gone to be a soldier. Tearfully. There was frantic horse buying. By the 8th of August, the Montgomerys are assembled and ready to move. Absence of horses, there was also a shortage of binoculars for them to use. So they take out a full-page advert in the Brecon and Radnor. Ladies and gentlemen, has anyone got any binoculars we could have, please? Because yet again, who are the major manufacturers of optical instruments in Europe? The Germans, Carl Zeiss. So people give up their binoculars to the Montgomerys for them to use. They start to move to a war footing. Now, I haven't got one today, but there are pictures of the squadrons riding through the various towns on their way to their muster point. They all met up, and it must look pretty spectacular. The squadrons, by this, the Welshpool squadron had been disbanded and distributed through the other squadrons, but they came down from Glenbuchlin and Newtown. The North Paris squadrons come down. Landrindard, the D squadron, went down via Hay, and they all met up for the first night on Hereford Racecourse, because they needed obviously somewhere that could look after horses, and they had the space to actually, you know, imagine a squadron's about 120 guys. So 120 guys, 120 horses. Now, a full cavalry regiment, you're talking 600 men and horses there. It must have looked pretty spectacular. They start, they make their way over through the Midlands towards East Anglia. On the way, D Squadron have to stop and send home Bugler Hope, because he's 14 years old. And we hadn't quite got to the point where we're using 14-year-olds to fight. It did happen. Youngest person killed in the British Army in World War I, Private Condon, was 14 years old. In fact, some 14 and 15-year-olds, when they went into recruiting offices, were told by the recruiting sergeant to come back in half an hour when they were 16. They end up in a place called Aylsham in Norfolk. By this time they've acquired their horses, and as you can see here, we actually have got a cavalry lines. Now 120 horses, in fact, well, 400 or 500 horses there would take a lot of looking after. Think of the associated blacksmithery and farrier skills needed to look after 600 horses. Think of the amounts of hay and oats you would need to feed that number of horses. And in fact, first couple of years of the First World War, something like 4 million tons of hay alone were carried over to the Western Front to feed horses. That's a lot of hay. Now what used to happen is the local photographer would rock up and take pictures on the lads. They would then take the photos and convert them into postcards, which you could then send to your rallies. You seen that one before, Megan? You seen that one before?
No.
No? Okay. And here again, there are two highways in this picture as well. Now, D Squadron, Tom Highway Section. By this time, he's a corporal, or rather a lance sergeant, because this is a cavalry regiment. This guy here, I don't know who he is, he may well be Private Hutt. More about him anon. As you can see, they're wearing the cap badge there of the Montgomeryshire Yeomanry with the motto, which is a Welsh word I can't pronounce, but it means invincible. They were actually staying in the grounds of Blickling Hall, which is in Norfolk. It's a National Trust property now. Birthplace of Anne Boleyn, if you ever go out that way. You can go there and have a look at that. The officers, of course, stayed in the big house. The seniors were put into local pubs. The junior ranks, of course, stayed under tents. And you see them here doing what they do, which is training, fooling around, joking. This chap here, I think, is one of the Edwards brothers of Landrindid. This one here is Church Parade, 1914. As you can see, this time they're fully suited and booted and ready to go. Big bandoliers of ammunition. All nice and smart, ready to go off and fight. Now, we've got these territorial regiments. Large numbers of them, but they are still effectively gentlemen amateurs. One night a week in an annual camp. They are not professional soldiers. So they're not as good, effectively, as the old contemptibles of the BEF, these guys who stopped the Germans at Mons, all right? The guy who could fire 10 shots out of a Lee Metford rifle and a figure 11 target at 600 yards in a minute. Yeah, they weren't as good. We did, however, have professional forces in places like India, Australia, New Zealand. So the idea of the exercises then, why don't we bring in all these forces from our Dominions and Commonwealth, the Indians, the Anzacs, over to the Western Front, and we'll backfill what they're doing, garrison duties, with our territorial force. Right, because that's not quite as hot at the moment. So what they did was they took the Montgomerys and they sent them to Egypt. They spent on the Norfolk coast about 12 months looking east from Cromer. Okay? Waiting for something to happen. They were doing basically defensive duty on the Norfolk coast. They then get sent to Egypt and they sail out of Plymouth in 1916 in a converted Royal Mail steam packet called the HMT Arcadian. Now, as they are sailing down through the Mediterranean, the Arcadian sails through the wreckage of two other transport ships that have been torpedoed. So the U-boats are out there, sinking everything left, right and Chelsea. The Arcadian makes it through. Now those of you who know your World War I history would remember these things about these PALS battalions, from places like Accrington and Bradford, where they recruited from a single town, and they went over the top on the first day of the Somme, shot to a man, and that actually had huge effects on the little locations and towns they came from, because they lost every single man in the town. It's quite possible then that the Arcadian might have been sunk in the Med with 120 of Landrinder's lads in it, and they've all gone down in a wanner. In fact, the Arcadian was sunk later on in the war off Greece. The loss of life was not great, because as she was sunk, they were practicing lifeboat drills. Coincidentally, yeah, it was very, very lucky. They come into the Egyptian port of Alexandria, where I've been. Absolute hellhole. And they end up sat in the desert doing garrison duty protecting the Suez Canal. Now, the Suez Canal is one of the five great naval choke points of the world. If you control the Suez Canal, you're in. Otherwise, your ships have to go all the way down around the Cape, all the way around back the other side, which adds 9,000 miles to your journey. So, realising, of course, the importance of this, over here we've got the Sinai Peninsula, up here we've got Palestine and Syria. Up here we've got the Ottoman Turks. They are in the war with the Germans. Not a hugely professional army. In fact, they've got lots of German military advisors on their staff. Now, the Germans, of course, realise that our resupply is coming through the Suez Canal. So they say to the Turks, would you mind awfully going down and becoming a complete pain on the Suez Canal? This is what they do. So the Ottomans start hassling the Suez Canal across Sinai in early 1915. Now, this area here is one enormous desert. Okay? So if you're going to make your way across there, not only are you going to carry all your guns and ammunition, but you've got to carry every single bit of water you're going to drink as well. So, yet again, as a military professional, we often say that amateurs talk tactics, professionals talk logistics, because that is what wars tend to be fought on. The Germans working with them were organisational geniuses, and they developed supply lines centred largely on railways down through Sinai that enabled them to carry water and supplies, particularly lots of camels down there to actually do this. The Ottoman attacks are largely unsuccessful. They then ignore Suez for about a year because they've got other things going on, for example, Gallipoli. Now, a couple of the towns were quite important in this. On the left-hand side there, we've got T.E. Lawrence. Lawrence of Arabia. Widely thought to be one of the greatest living Englishmen of the 20th century, when in fact he was Welsh. Born in Tramadoc. Guy on the right is General Allenby. More about him and all. Played in the film Lawrence of Arabia by Jack Hawkins, those of you who remember the film. In 916, the Turks come down and have another go. Now, there are only three ways you can get through the Sinai. Bottom route, middle route, top route. So they come down the top route and have another go, and they get defeated at a place called Romani. By this stage, the British High Command have had enough of being hassled by the Turks. Now, you ask any infantry soldier what their role is in life. It is advance to the enemy, kill them, dominate the ground. So, why not, instead of just sat here and letting these enemy come to us, why don't we go out into the Sinai and kick it up a bit? So what they did was they sent the Australians out to smash up all the oases and water storage facilities that the Ottomans had got in the Sinai. So yet again, they reduced this to one enormous parched piece of land. And from that point on, you're actually quite safe, because the threat really from the Ottoman Turks has reduced. Now, really, by this time, the offensive age of the horse in war is over. Cavalry really has had its day. So unfortunately, the Montgomerys this time get their horses taken off them and told they're going to be remustered as infantry. So they are remustered into the 25th Battalion of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, along with an organisation called the Welsh Horse, which was another yeomanry regiment that somebody had founded in the First World War. So all the yeomanry regiments, and there were lots of them, Flintshire, Denbighshire, Gloucester, Leicester yeomanry, all had their horses taken away. They were formed into one big fighting division, the 74th Division. Now, how pleased do you think they were to have their horses taken off them? Not at all, absolutely not. So they took as their divisional badge a broken spur to signify they had once been horsemen and the horses were still at the back of their mind. Now, yet again, a little bit of all-bat training here for you. Allenby's army consisted of two corps, 21 and 20. 20 Corps was under Lieutenant General Chetwood. Now, 74th Div, the Yeomanry Div, sat under Chetwood in his all-bat. Now, that division, yet again, is broken up into a number of brigades. 74th Div is run by Major General Girdwood. He's got 231, 230, and 229 Brigade. The 231 Brigade is consisting at that time of four regiments, 25 RWF, who are our guys, and three other regiments as well. Within 25 RWF, we've got four companies, A, B, C, and D. The Montgomerys were smashed up and put into A and B Company. The Welsh Horse went and formed C and D Company. So from now on, we're not really talking about the Montgomerys. We're talking about 25 RWF. Still our guys from Landrindid. But there they are. Now, another Welshman is going to get his two pence worth in. 1917, the campaign in Sinai has been going pretty well. In fact, it's about the only thing in the entire war that's going well. Now, Lloyd George, who's a very astute political man, sees this. And of course, 1917, you've got third Battle of Ypres, Passchendaele, complete and total disaster. He needs good news. There are people in the government, people in the country who are saying, well, it's about time we sued for peace with the Kaiser. We've had enough of this. He needs good news. So he says to the High Command in the Middle East, would you mind terribly invading Palestine for me? Okay. All the time we've got this happening, we've got Lawrence of Arabia, who is with his Arabs, leading the Arab revolt. And they are basically running up and down on the eastern flank, blowing up railways, destroying water. And if you remember from the film, they do the attack on Aqaba, which is the port on the Red Sea that the Ottomans hold. And there's that very famous scene where he claims to have walked all the way through the desert in 39 hours or whatever it was. Complete rubbish. But he took his Arabs and they capture Aqaba. So, would you mind awfully going off and invading Palestine? Now, in charge of the army at this time is a guy called General Murray. Now, of course, every single bomb, bullet, gallon of water you need to take into battle has got to be carried. So what they actually do is they construct a railway back into Sinai and run a water line alongside it. Huge amounts of labour involved in doing this. What they do is they get the Egyptian Labour Corps, these local Egyptian levies, set them in the heat with a shovel, digging a railway. And the effort involved in this is absolutely phenomenal. They run this railway up the coast, and in 1917, there's a battle at a place called Rafa, where they decidedly defeat the Ottomans, and that's them finished in Sinai. However, we now then need to move into Palestine. Yep. We've got the next big sort of place to come to is Gaza. Yet again, still, you know, important in Israeli history today. Notice none of this really, all this fighting is taking with about 20, 30 miles of the coast. They're hugging the coast. Because out here, an enormous expanse of nothingness. You know, heat, dust flies. How much water does a horse drink? Well, a horse drinks about as much as 30 blokes do. So, a cavalry regiment of 600 horses will drink as much water as 18,000 men. Murray attacks Gaza. Now, there is a large chain of defences stretching inland from Gaza. Murray tries the tactic of banging his head against it. First attack is disastrous. Second Battle of Gaza in April 1917 is similarly disastrous. There are 6,000 casualties. Now, our guys from Landrind at this point have not engaged, because for the Second Battle of Gaza, 74 Div are held to the back as a reserve. So casualties, therefore, do not happen. This is the Turkish defensive line, one of the Turkish defensive lines on Gaza. You can see it's interlocking machine guns. Very, very low rolling ground. Very, very large fields of view. If you go anywhere near those, you're going to get absolutely and totally taken out. It's so disastrous that Murray is replaced as the general officer commanding by Allenby. So we end up at a place called Beersheba. Now, the Montgomerys, the men of Landrinda, would have been God-fearing men. And as they went through these towns, they would have seen names they would have seen in their Bibles on a Sunday morning in Sunday school. In Gaza. It's Samson, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Eyeless in Gaza. Yeah. Beersheba. Mentioned from the book of Genesis onwards. Beersheba is wells, Beersheba is water. Okay, now that's a very busy map. That's because it's a professional military one. Bear with me. Here is the defensive line across Gaza and Beersheba. Now the Turks decide to stop it here and leave a gap between Beersheba and the Gaza defensive line. They rationalise that in order to take 50,000 men and horses that far inland, they're just all going to die of thirst in the desert. So they don't need to actually fortify that, because the desert will do the rest. Yeah. However, what they actually do is they bring a branch of the railway line across here. Very, very, very quietly. If it's possible to build a railway quietly. They also do quite a large amount of deception tactics. They get the Royal Navy, some battleships off Gaza to shell Gaza. They've also got a very small force outside Gaza, running up and down, waving their arms and pretending to be much bigger than they are. Meanwhile, Allenby rocks up to Beersheba with 40,000 men, who can be supplied by this railway, but it's going to be a very close-run thing. Okay, I'll come back to that one in a minute. Now, somebody, when I was doing this talk last week, somebody from Landrindad, whose grandfather had been out there, and she said to me, "Can you tell me, my grandfather said that everywhere he fought, he was always alongside Australians." And she was absolutely right, because the Montgomerys, when they fought in the Holy Land and when they fought in France, were always alongside Australian formations and fought alongside them. The Australians had an organisation called the Australian Light Horse. Now, these are not cavalry. Your Montgomery cavalry would have a huge horse with a great big sword. The idea is you wander around, you just wave your sabre across the top of somebody's head and take it off quite nicely, thank you very much. The Australian Light Horse rode into battle. They've got a rifle. They ride in sticks of four. They ride so far up to the battle, then they all dismount off their little Brumby pack horses. One of the guys takes the bridles of the four horses, leads them to the rear. The other three then advance into battle. They fight their battle. If anyone were left, they get back on their horses and ride out. This is all very well, except while you're getting off and dismounting, people can actually drop artillery shells on top of you. You're absolutely sitting target. And they were actually the Australian Light Horse in the first two battles were actually used very, very, very poorly. At Beersheba, on the 31st of October 1917, Allenby fights all day. They don't manage to smash Beersheba. Now, it's getting a bit dodgy, because you've got 40 to 50,000 people and horses there, sat. The horses haven't had any water for 3 days. The men haven't had any water now approaching, we need to resupply for approaching a day. Things are starting to get a bit critical, and if they don't do something soon, they will lose this battle. At about 6:30 on the 31st of October, the Australian commander in charge of the Light Horse decides to send in, as a last throw of the dice, a brigade of the Light Horse. One of his officers said to him, "Well, I tell you what, why don't we just have a charge at it?" "Well, we don't normally do that." "Well, let's have a go with a charge." Beersheba has got 17 wells. It's the water. You've got Beersheba, you're safe. All right, and what happened? I'll show you a little film now. It looked like this.
Australian film.
Yep, that's called The Light Horseman.
The Light Horseman. Yeah. When would that have been made?
That was made in 1987.
87?
Yeah. Okay. You can get it on Amazon. Yeah. Just make sure you get the right region DVD.
Yes.
Yeah. My new favourite film, though. The Light Horseman. What basically happened there, they didn't expect there was a charge because that's not what Light Horseman did. But they did. They weren't cavalrymen, they didn't have swords, so they took their bayonets out and charged. In fact, the Turks couldn't just depress the sights on their weapons fast enough to shoot them, so they were actually shooting over the top of them constantly. obviously dramatised, there were no machine guns because British counter-battery artillery had taken it out by then. Also, the casualties there exaggerated a bit. That was a brigade-size attack, probably the best part of 2,000 men and horses. They suffered 31 dead. That is probably the only successful attack in the history in modern warfare using sort of horse formations. It was astounding. They captured 15 of the 17 wells. They then got the engineers in to repair the broken ones, and in about a week they'd got a daily capacity for about 350,000 gallons of water. Now, that of course meant that the yeomanry divisions, including our guys from Landrindid, could then supply, get behind the defensive wall, and then do what we in the military call rolling up a flank. Okay, just basically make your way along an undefended position. Okay, and Lloyd George had said to Allenby, "I want you in Jerusalem by Christmas. That is your goal." And that indeed is what Allenby managed to accomplish. In fact, he went on after that into Syria and captured Damascus as well. Our guys are not involved in that, because by this stage it is mid-1918. Things are going badly on the Western Front again. The Kaiser's last throw of the dice, the Kaiser's offensive, also known as Operation Michael, smashed through Allied formations and actually pushed them back to more or less where they'd started at the start of the war. So, you know, the last 3 years they've been basically doing that on the Western Front. Millions of lives lost. As somebody once said, to move General Haig's drinks cabinet 3 miles closer to Berlin. The upshot of this is Allenby loses 60 infantry battalions to go back to France to fight the Kaiser. So, 25 RWF, ex-Montgomery's, sail back through the torpedo-infested Mediterranean on a P&O packet called the SS Malwa. They come into Marseille, they sit behind the lines for a while, they then find themselves fighting the battles of the last 100 days of the war on the Hindenburg Line, a place called Epahy. September 1918, they go into battle at Epahy, they suffer 65 casualties. During that action, Sergeant Waring, military medal, who was from Montgomery, he was from just outside Welshpool, wins the Victoria Cross. He's killed, it's posthumous, he's killed in the trench as well. Incidentally, attached to 25 RWF at this point is this chap on the right-hand side. Anybody recognise him? It is the war poet Siegfried Sassoon. Now, he'd started out in the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. He'd been so horrified by what he'd seen at places like Mametz Wood, he took his military cross and threw it in the Mersey and refused to go back and fight. Now, he was an influential man, he was of the upper class, he was an author and poet. He wrote a very, very long letter to the Times saying, I'm not fighting anymore. They sent him to a psychiatric hospital at Craig Lockhart in Scotland, attempting to prove he was mad, because, of course, he was actually having prejudicial effect on the conduct of the war. He eventually agreed to go back and fight and was posted in Palestine during the last days of that campaign into 25 RWF, and therefore ended up in the trenches with our guys from Landrin. However, he was there about a week before he was shot in the head, allegedly by a friendly fire incident. So he wasn't there long before he was casavacked back out again. But he's noted in the regimental history. The Hindenburg Line, in front of it, had some high ground. Now, the idea of the exercise with this assault was to actually take the high ground as a prelude to actually advancing onto the Hindenburg Line. They were actually advancing onto stuff which until recently had been British fortifications, because the Germans had just pushed them back. 25 RWF, on the flank of the Australian 2 Corps, end up assaulting something called the quadrilateral, which was a defensive position. By the 25th of September, 7 officers and 32 men killed, 300 had been wounded, largely by judicious use of gas. And by this stage, the battalion actually ceases to exist as a fighting formation and is taken out of the line. Now, we're bordering on the end of the war here. November 11th sounds off, and we get peace and the armistice. The regiment comes back into this country to Welshpool. Now, at this stage, we've got a standing army of several million men that we do not need, and no money. We do not need all these regiments, so large quantities of them are disbanded. In fact, all the ex-yeomanry regiments, with the exception of the 12 most senior, are disbanded. So, 25 RWF, and hence the Montgomeryshire Yeomanry, cease to exist. One last parade is held in Welshpool in 1920, and the guidons, which are the squadron flags, if you like, along with the battalion pennant, are laid up in St Mary's Church in Welshpool, where they still are, if you want to go and have a look at them. Okay, as regimental colours are, they are left there, they are not maintained and cleaned, the idea being that over time they fade away, rather like old soldiers do. This is a picture of Beersheba Commonwealth Graveyard. It's about 70 miles south of Jerusalem. Immaculately maintained, as they inevitably are. In this graveyard, there are two guys from Landrinden. Okay. Corporal Hutt, who we saw earlier as Private Hutt, killed on the 31st of October, the day that charge happened. Edward Daines Hutt. He's one of. He came from Chatsworth Villas down on Waterloo Road, which is not far from the crossing chip shop there. His mother lost two sons in the war. The other Daines Hutt is also commemorated on the war memorial. There was another chap in there, Private Smith, who was the only Smith, spookily enough, on the war memorial. He was from Llanoily, over the top of the golf course. He was also killed on the 31st of October as well. So there are two guys from Landrinded in that graveyard. A very long way from home, I think you'll agree. But that, ladies and gentlemen, is it. That shows the path of the Montgomerys from Landrinded through Norfolk, out to Egypt, up through the Holy Land, then back through France. Now, the chap I had, the relative I had, whose daughter-in-law is in the audience today, arrived back in Landrinded, gassed and shell-shocked. Now, had a military pension, but of course that was not enough really to live on. Now, these days, if you had that kind of injury, Help for Heroes would look after you a bit, and you could probably scrape along on what you could get. These were different times. He actually went back to work in a coal mine, which is probably the most roughy, tufty, nasty occupation you could think of, very easy to do in those times. It shows really the type of desperation that people had in the interwar years. It was certainly not a land fit for heroes they came back to. for certain. Thank you very much for listening. It's been an absolute pleasure. Hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll see you next year.